Welcome to Sound Practice, the business podcast for physicians and healthcare leaders, hosted by Mike Tsakopoulos and produced by the American Association for Physician Leadership.
I want to go out at the top, but the secret is knowing when you're at the top. It's so difficult in this business. Your career fluctuates all the time, up and down, like a pair of trousers. Rod Stewart. Mr. Stewart has put his finger on it. It's not always easy to know when you are in decline. Like aging rockers, some surgeons suffer loss of abilities. The question is, when do you know? My guest today has some answers. Next on Sound Practice. My guest today is Mark Catlett. Dr. Catlett is the Chair Emeritus of Surgery for LifeBridge Health System in Baltimore. He helped create the Aging Surgeon Program. Mark Catlett, welcome to Sound Practice.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, it's our absolute pleasure to have you. Before we delve into the Aging Surgeon Program, could you please tell me about your career path as a physician?
I went to Washington and Jefferson College in Western Pennsylvania, small liberal arts college, and then Johns Hopkins School of Medicine in Baltimore, and the Massachusetts General Hospital for residencies in surgery and cardiothoracic surgery. And so for many years, I practiced in private practice general surgery and general thoracic surgery in northeastern Pennsylvania. And then I became basically a little more academic over my career, joining the Geisinger Health System, and then subsequently joining LifeBridge Health System in Baltimore as their chief of surgery 13 years ago. I'm a general thoracic surgeon, basically, in practice.
Excellent. Preparing to speak with you today, I looked at some material, and I have to admit, I was surprised by some of the studies linking age of surgeon to higher rates of patient mortality. Would you describe the problem of aging surgeons for us?
Well, first of all, this is not a huge problem in terms of numbers of surgeons. However, there are many surgeons still practicing in their 70s and a few even in their 80s. And so even though it's not an enormous number of surgeons, it is a problem that most chiefs of surgery will encounter sometime during their career, or hospital president or chief medical officer, because it just does happen. You know, we can't deny biology. You know, there are deteriorations in both physical and cognitive functions with increasing age. That's just the reality. And surgeons are human, so it happens to them also. The problem is people like to be surgeons. You know, they like operating, and generally cases go well. One receives a lot of gratification from doing good work in the operating room, and patients are typically very grateful. At the same time, surgeons have spent so much time training to be a surgeon, and the lifestyle is so intense that many have not developed interests outside the hospital, you know, hobbies or other interests. And so there's great incentive to continue operating and less incentive to retire to do something else, to leave the OR. And so that's where the problem comes in. It's that surgeons are not particularly self-aware. They like what they're doing, and therefore they continue to do it. But some tiny percentage of those surgeons will have problems and will put patients at risk and their hospitals at risk for liability and themselves at risk for liability. So the American College of Surgeons has a category called something like senior surgeons. It's surgeons over 70 who are still practicing. They don't have to pay dues. There are 11,000 surgeons in that category. But we know that not every surgeon in the country belongs to the American College of Surgeons. And so if one sort of extrapolates, there could be 20,000, 30,000, even more surgeons over 70 still practicing. So if even a few percent of those surgeons are cognitively impaired in any way, for example, or have unrecognized medical problems, then that's where the problem lies. So it's not an enormous number, but the consequences are high, even for those, even if it's a few.
In many specialties of medicine and in geographic areas in the country, there's a lack of surgeons, or at least not enough surgeons to meet demand. Does this fact encourage some surgeons to practice too long?
I think that's absolutely true. And also is an argument for why there should not be a mandatory retirement age. You know, we do need good older surgeons. As you pointed out, there are counties in the United States that have 0 to 1 general surgeon. And sometimes that's an older general surgeon. And so as a resource to society, we need those folks. And that's a strong argument against mandatory retirement age. One other argument against mandatory retirement age is that the variability among individuals actually increases with increasing age. So if we test a number of 40-year-olds or even 50-year-olds, we don't really find major differences. But as we get to 70 and 80-year-olds, the variability among individuals increases. So some are still very, very good, but some are getting bad. And so therefore, if just to pick a mandatory retirement age would be unscientific, it would be unfair, and you would take away those surgeons that are necessary for some places in America.
Could you describe how the aging surgeon program works?
Well, it's a 2-day comprehensive program. And it took us about a year to build this, by the way. I sat down with members of various specialties, and including even hospital lawyers and physical therapists and ophthalmologists and physical and occupational therapy folks. It took us about a year, and I charged those folks with coming up with a practical evaluation in their area of expertise. And then so we put this all together into a 2-day comprehensive evaluation. So a surgeon will come to Baltimore, typically the night before. They'll come in, have a nice little breakfast and talk to me typically. But then they'll have a physical exam, a neurology exam, and then have a whole afternoon of neurocognitive evaluation. So these are typical neurocognitive tests that are done on individuals with so-called high executive functioning, typically, you know, professionals. And then they'll leave the hospital, have dinner on their own, come back the next day for more neurocognitive testing, some physical and occupational therapy testing, which test hand-eye coordination, fine motor skills, balance, and which all of which are important for surgeons, not necessarily for, say, psychiatrists, but important for surgeons. And then have a comprehensive eye exam. And they have a brief hearing screen, too, during all this. And then they leave. And our individual departments send comprehensive reports in. And then we meet as a group, typically on a Friday. And then we prepare an executive summary. And all of that is sent as an encrypted PDF document to whomever contracted for the evaluation. Typically, a hospital president, chief of surgery, couple surgeons sent themselves. They came on their own because they wanted to know, you know, were they competent. And so that, anyway, that's the basics of the program.
What are the typical costs associated with a surgeon being evaluated through the program?
It costs $10,000.
Okay.
And so, and actually that's less than when we started. We've managed to find by holding the evaluations in certain so-called unregulated space in Maryland, it's a little less expensive. And we don't make any money on this, by the way. That's simply what it costs for all this comprehensive two-day evaluation. And so we require that money up front. We put it into an escrow account, and then the various departments that evaluate the surgeon draw from that account at Sinai Hospital.
What about confidentiality? If a surgeon chooses to ignore or minimize the results of his or her evaluation, assuming that they're the ones that ordered the evaluation or started the process, as opposed to a hospital, are the results reportable?
We hold confidentiality in with great respect. We will send the encrypted report only to that person who contracted for the evaluation, basically who paid for the evaluation, and to no one else, short of a court order. Now, we actually recently did receive a court order from a physician who had been, I think, relieved of certain privileges at his hospital, and he did not contract for the evaluation himself, and so he did not have the results of his evaluation. The hospital would not provide him results of the evaluation, which had been sent to the hospital. But his lawyers were able to obtain a court order that required us, to relinquish the document to them, which we did. But failing that, we will only send the document to whomever contracted for it. Now, we do get permission up front from the individual that allows us, if we find findings that we believe are dangerous to the individual, particularly to the individual, that we can notify his or her family member or personal physician. But we will not report it to a state board of medicine, for example, short of a court order.
Does the testing yield only binary results? I mean, either the surgeon is competent to operate or not. It seems possible that a surgeon may be completely competent to perform some minor or lesser procedures, but not other procedures. Am I wrong?
You're not wrong, and it is not a binary report. It is a more of a... Now, there's a lot of quantitative information in the individual evaluations, but the executive summary tends to be more qualitative description, summary of the results. And you're absolutely right. There could be findings that would allow a surgeon to do some things, but not other things. For example, in some of the physical therapy evaluations and occupational therapy evaluations of the surgeon's hand functions, sometimes the evaluator will determine that under certain conditions of stress or after a long period of doing the test, that the function deteriorated. And so, and similarly with some of the neurocognitive tests, there may be findings that say the cognition was not within normal limits when attention was divided or when there was under so-called noisy conditions or distracted conditions. So there may be findings in the report that would still allow a surgeon to do something, but maybe not everything. And those types of decisions, however, are left to whomever contracted for the evaluation. So we are not going to make credentialing decisions or even credentialing recommendations, or privileging recommendations, I should say. We might occasionally make a soft recommendation. We also have found ways to improve a surgeon's function. We found one older orthopedic surgeon who had been sent to us because of falling asleep, frankly, during cases and not performing well during long cases. And we determined that he simply was not managing his diabetes well. And he was having hypoglycemic episodes, likely during these operations. And, you know, many surgeons don't see their doctor very often, don't take care of themselves very often. And so with proper diabetes management, he's still operating. And this was years ago. He's still operating and apparently doing fine. There may be conditions whereby a surgeon can be taken off the call schedule or his or her schedule limited to allow that surgeon to get more rest, at night. There may be conditions whereby that surgeon can still see patients in a clinic but not do major cases, or has to have another surgeon as an assistant, for example. There are all sorts of options, but we will not say this surgeon can continue or should not continue.
At what age do you believe surgeons should start being evaluated for age-related competency?
That's a very good question, and it actually leads me into the type of policy we have at all of our three hospitals within our LifeBridge Health System in Baltimore. There's a policy called a late career practitioner policy. And this applies to everybody on the medical staff, not just surgeons. And we set that age at 75. And other hospital systems, although there are very few that have these policies, others have set it at 70 or 72 or 75. Our policy says that at age 75, you have to have a physical exam, an eye exam, and a two-hour neurocognitive screening evaluation by a PhD neuropsychologist of our choosing. That's our so-called late career practitioner policy, and one must do it at every time they come up for reprivileging when they're over 75. So that's every 2 years right now at our hospital. That's called a late career practitioner policy. We just chose 75, completely arbitrary, because it was old enough to not be as controversial, but not too old. And by the way, there are some members of our medical staff leadership that think we should start a little sooner now. We've been doing this for 6 or 7 years, and although controversial at many hospitals, and although many hospitals don't have the policy for that reason, it's worked very well at our hospitals. Now, I'm actually an advocate for groups in surgery to have similar evaluations for surgeons, basically to police ourselves before someone else does it. So if our American Board of Surgery had a similar requirement when one comes up for recertification, what's called maintenance of certification now in surgery, and that's every 2 years, by the way, but if the board had the requirement that you had to send in a neurocognitive evaluation when you apply for maintenance of certification, then suddenly surgeons would be evaluated. And I think the public could sleep a little better, frankly. You know, it came up in our recent presidential election that maybe high-impact professions should undergo some form of evaluation. And I think you can make a strong case for that. So I don't believe any board of medicine or surgery has such a requirement now. I understand it would be very controversial, but I'm frankly going to continue to encourage surgical organizations to think about that. So that's a long-winded answer to your question. But so whether you pick age 70, 72, 75, something in that range seems appropriate.
Is there a concern with false positives from the evaluation process?
These are tests that have been done for the general public for years and years and years. So all the tests that we do have been validated within the neuropsychology literature and have been used for years for occupational therapy evaluations and neurocognitive evaluations of professionals, frankly. Similarly, the PT and OT, physical therapy, occupational therapy tests have been done for years, and they're standard hand therapy evaluations, standard physical therapy evaluations of reaction time and coordination and balance and fine motor skills. And so the chances of a false positive are extremely low. One could also point out that you would want your surgeon to be at least as good as the general public in cognition and physical function.
That seems hard to argue with.
Yeah.
Do you know any professional liability insurers that require older surgeons to be evaluated?
I'm not aware of a single one.
You would think that they would have a natural interest in knowing the abilities of those they insure.
I think you're absolutely right. And it probably would be a forward-thinking insurer who instituted that requirement. But I'm not aware. Now, it could be the case, but I'm not aware that any insurer has that requirement.
Since you've helped with the inception of this program, has there been anything that's really surprised you about how the program has gone?
I've been a little surprised that we haven't had more surgeons come through our program. We've had perhaps two dozen, maybe as many as 30 over the years that we've been doing the program, which is, I think, about 10 years, almost 10 years. So we're not seeing huge numbers of surgeons. Now, we've had tremendous interest, and I've received inquiries from every state in the United States and many foreign countries, frankly. Anybody that doesn't have a mandatory retirement age, some countries do, but if you don't have a mandatory retirement age, this is an issue. And so there's been a great deal of interest in the topic, and I've actually been invited to speak overseas. I've been to Korea, been to Amsterdam, been to England, and had other interest in our program. I also know that many surgeons have voluntarily retired or retired from the operating room when so-called threatened with our program. In other words, rather than be forced to come through our program, they have voluntarily stepped down or changed what they do. And that's just anecdotal, but I've heard that that's happened. And so I think that the program, the existence of the program, has affected more people than just the relatively few surgeons that have come through our program.
It seems to me that cognitive problems are not always the result of aging. Would your program accept someone that maybe is younger than the average age, but there was questions of cognition?
Yes, we would. We have tried to exclude people with drug dependency issues. However, we have evaluated two or three surgeons returning from major illness or major surgery, and their hospital simply wanted to be certain that they were good. So one had had major transplant, and another had brain surgery. And both did fine, actually. But their hospitals wanted to be sure that they were safe. In a way, I think our program also provides the hospitals with some security, some feeling of security that they've gone the extra mile to make sure that these surgeons are safe, just in case something would happen.
Well, I think that this program makes all the sense in the world, and there should be lots of interest in it. As our time together draws to a close, can you tell me how people interested in the Aging Surgeon program can learn more?
Well, I think if you type in Aging Surgeon Program in any search engine, the program will come up. There's a fairly simple website. We have a coordinator who is a nurse, a very experienced nurse practitioner, Jasmine Demos, and she her phone number is on the website. Anybody can also look me up on a search engine, and the program will come up, or my contact information will come up. So anyway, they can contact me or can go to the website and look up Aging Surgeon Program. It's readily easy to find.
Well, this is certainly a great service that you offer to your colleagues and to the general public indirectly. So thank you. Thank you very much for that. My guest has been Dr. Mark Catlett. Mark Catlett, thank you so much for being on Sound Practice.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
My thanks to Dr. Mark Catlett. He has taken on a problem faced by the surgical community and in the process made things safer for some patients. Mark Catlett is a true physician leader. My thanks also to the American Association for Physician Leadership for making this podcast possible. Please join me next time on Sound Practice. We release a new episode every other Wednesday.
You've been listening to Sound Practice, the business podcast for physicians and healthcare leaders. Check out the show notes for this episode at soundpracticepodcast.com. If you have any suggestions for future episodes, we'd love to hear them. Email us at info@soundpracticepodcast.com. Subscribe to Sound Practice wherever you listen to podcasts so you can automatically receive our episodes. And please rate us and comment on the podcast in iTunes and Google Play. Sound Practice is presented and produced by the team at American Association for Physician Leadership. We are the world's premier organization for all aspects of physician leadership in every sector of healthcare. Learn more at physicianleaders.org.
That man Robin. Ripple Kapow.